Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan, and I'm very excited today about our special guest, author Eleanor O'Rourke. I met Eleanor in the garden in Rennes-le-Château, and we're going to talk about that because we talk about the magical things that happen in France very often on this show. So we will get there. But what I discovered about Eleanor very quickly is that she's an extraordinary writer. She had just written a book called 40 Days, 40 Nights, One Woman's Quest to Reclaim Her Creative Mojo, which we're going to talk about. I love this book, and I can't wait to share it with all of you. The writing is just, this book is so much fun to read. It is witty and wise, and just full of such extraordinarily entertaining stories and anecdotes, but all of them really have sort of extraordinary lessons within them as well. So before I continue to babble, I want to say welcome, Eleanor O'Rourke.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is, it's brilliant. Thank you.
And then in addition to discovering this wonderful book that she wrote, and once I came back to the States, I subscribed to your blogs. And I have to say that you are currently my favorite voice on the blogosphere. I absolutely read every word you write. I think your blogs are fantastic. I really am. I've become, you know, your biggest fan in the blogosphere.
Oh my God. Well, thank you. That's
so
wonderful.
Let's get started with who is Eleanor, because, you know, Eleanor O'Rourke is hard to say if you say it quickly, all those R's.
So,
who is Eleanor O'Rourke? How did you get started on this journey? You've had, and you talk about in your book, and we'll go through it in detail, but just sort of in general, I know you were born in Liverpool. How did you grow up? What were your spiritual influences growing up? And where did this journey really get started for you?
I suppose I ended up coming full circle. I started off a good Catholic girl, and I adored something about the Catholic religion. And later on, when I went to study NLP, I realized that they had the whole sensory surround experience going on with the incense and the stained glass and, you know, the visual thing, the auditory thing, the Gregorian chants. And I didn't put it together at that time, but I remember having these extraordinary experiences as a small child, to do with the majesty of churches. And I just loved the whole thing about going into a church and going into this altered state. Then I went through the typical teenage thing where I started to, you know, develop a left brain and then thought the whole of the Catholic religion was, you know, quite insane. And particularly the historical thing when I started to read into the history of religion and the things that it was responsible for and the patriarchy. And so I ditched religion completely and put it to one side and wanted to have a free spirited life. So I left Liverpool and the small town kind of environment that I grew up in and joined rock and roll. So that sort of gave me all my, you know, ticked all the boxes on the freedom things, so that I was able to travel and not have a conventional lifestyle and a conventional 9-to-5 job. And that worked really well for a while. So I really developed that whole left brain, very strong masculine thing by taking charge of my own destiny after coming from a long line of Catholic women, for which you may as well say Catholic martyrs. A lot of the Liverpool Catholic women had 6, 8 children. I was one of 6. My best friend, Mary O'Leary, had 11 children in their family. And the women were these incredibly stoic, hardworking, but ultimately the picture of them was them standing in front of a pile of ironing that never went down. And my reaction to that was, you know, I just don't ever want to be one of those women. So typically, like a kind of baby boomer, like so many of us, I rejected that whole way of life and went off and had a career. And so when I met my husband and got married, I was still in that kind of very masculine energy of I ran the family in a kind of with a to-do list. Everything got done, everybody was fed and clothed, and the money got earned, and but there was something missing in my life that I couldn't identify at the time, which was the whole of the left side of me, the feminine energy was missing, you know. And I was very driven, very successful, very practical. And so I think, as happens to many people, when you don't address that imbalance in your life, it addresses you. And so I had a complete major life crash, at which point I lost, you know, my business, the successful business, my house, my husband. The whole thing kind of went in a pack of cards, and that's the thing that started the spiritual journey. Unfortunately, for many of us, it takes a life crash to be drawn towards a spiritual journey, and that's where it all started.
Now, your life in the rock and roll world was very interesting, and you had a pretty heavyweight job and were doing some amazing things, but to your point, they required a lot of masculine energy. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you?
I think when you come from a place of having very little power, which, you know, girls are traditionally brought up to be sweet and to be, you know, approval seeking and to get the boyfriend and to be pretty. When you get a job and you have a certain amount of responsibility, it's you love it so much because suddenly you feel in control of your life. And, you know, that's a real, that is a buzz. And you start to, it becomes quite addictive. So then you just want to have, like, you know, more responsibility. And for women, they tend to, instead of playing the game like men in that day and age, sort of going back, this is, you know, going back a little bit, men tended to do it through just contacts and networks, and women had to work very much harder to get the same kind of opportunities as men. They had to never ever screw up. So that fear of not ever screwing up kind of, you know, makes them sometimes very controlling because they've got to cross all the T's and dot the I's and make sure nothing's forgotten. And so, I think it's a typical one for many people these days, you know, the whole thing about wanting to be successful in a career and becoming, you know, really imbalanced about it.
Well, and I think that this is something that it's a fascinating dilemma, I think, in our generation, because I think that we are the first generation of women to have this pressure, and a lot of it which we put upon ourselves to be all things to all people all the time. Mm-hmm. And certainly I came from the Hollywood world. I came from the world of the studios. Where in order to be a successful woman, you had to become a killer. And you had to develop this, you know, sort of killer instinct in order to survive in that world, which didn't openly welcome women into it. And so in so many ways, we were working against our basic nature and against type. And that certainly takes a toll. But I do think that we are the first generation of women to have this desire to have a career, and prove something in terms of our own independence, while at the same time deal with these other issues that we have, and the other desire to either have children or have a committed relationship, have a home life. It's very, very complicated. And I think in a lot of ways, this idea of writing spiritual material or inspirational material is kind of the Wild West. We're pioneering something here that, you know, really hasn't been examined in a lot of ways. One of the things I talk about with a lot of women in my life, a lot of women I know are either going through or have recently gone through a divorce because of these same kind of issues. They had these life crashes. I had one 3 years ago, same thing, you know, ended my marriage and lost my house and, you know, had some issues in my career. And I'm finding that so many of us are going through that. but it almost feels necessary. I mean, like you said, you almost have to have this kind of a crash. It's sort of the old, you know, addiction idea of you have to hit bottom before you can recover. Mm. And are you finding that with the other women in your life? You certainly do with the other woman you write about in this book. But has that also been your observation, that a lot of women around you or friends have been through these same kinds of issues and crashes?
Yeah, totally. And to me, it's almost like we're birthing a new archetype, because the old archetypes, we've polarized now. I see it as the world of duality has come to a critical point where the polarization, neither of the two roles offered to women thus far in a career. I mean, I liken it in the book to the Peter Pan story, where you have two options. One is Tinkerbell and one is Wendy. And in rock and roll, if you were very beautiful and skinny and could get into a pair of spandex trousers, then you would do the Tinkerbell thing, and your job opportunities were the girlfriend of the band or the record company secretary. And then there was the Wendy, who was the nurturer, carer, mother type, who would dish out aspirins and have one of those Mary Poppins bags with, you know, everything from biscuits to paracetamol to mobile phone chargers. But there was, you know, those two very different things. If you could play up the kind of femme fatale sex kitten thing, or you could do that the nurturing mother thing, which was, you know, often the thing that people would choose. If they couldn't cut it in one area, they'd go to another area. And neither of those roles work anymore, because both of them are untrue. And yet there isn't a new archetype. All the leaders and that we've seen, like people like Margaret Thatcher, or leaders, CEOs of companies, they're basically men in dresses. I mean, that's not a way forward at all. And sometimes the nurturing mother kind of archetype has been ineffectual and passive, and like the women from the Mothers of Liverpool, very martyred, very well-meaning but ineffective. So there needs to be this new archetype that hasn't yet been birthed, and that's why it's so difficult for us, because we're the pioneers in that new realm.
And it's exciting, but it's also scary. And I think that the Tinkerbell Wendy thing is really the ancient whore Madonna archetype.
Yeah.
It's really the same thing. And as you say, it no longer serves us. And then we went through this period in the 80s and the 90s where a new archetype was being birthed. But as you say, it was the Margaret Thatcher, model, which was the man in the dress. And that doesn't work either. And so we have to move away from that. I certainly worked for a number of men in dresses when I was in the studios in the 90s. And it was not pleasant for anybody. But to your point, we are moving into a new kind of archetype. And it is something that's wholly balanced. But we don't know what it looks like, because we haven't seen it in such a very, very long time. And that is where material like yours, books like yours, stories about the journey, I think, become really, really important, because they give us a little bit of a handbook, first of all, to be free with it, to, you know, first of all, stand up and say, we are doing something new. We are pioneers. The world is changing, and it is, you know, incumbent upon us to be that change. And the beauty of what you write about is that you write about doing this via creativity. And we talk a lot about creativity on this show, because we're all writers, and we work with a lot of writers and artists. And I am a firm believer that we are the closest to God when we're creating, whatever that looks like. Creator and creativity all coming from that same root of creation. So how did you, at what point did you hit upon this as the linchpin for you? At what point did you say, I need to get in touch with my creative spirit? I need to do something here where I am creating a new self. Where did that really come from for you?
For me, it came from the failure of the self-help movement, because obviously when I did have my life crash, I went in a very left brain fashion to, I've got a problem, I've got to sort it out, I've got three small children, and this can't take 10 minutes. I, you know, this can't take 10 years. It's got to take not 10 minutes, but I really want this done in sort of like, a weekend. And so I went very purposefully into the whole thing of, the self-help movement, and I crossed them off one by one: psychotherapy, Jungian psychotherapy, psycho-spiritual models. And while going through that, I kind of observed that it doesn't really work for people, that, that the whole thing about creativity was being in some way misinterpreted, because I have this like dual thing. It's like this creativity and love, and both of them suffer from a problem of definition, because we're defining them through the old paradigm. So creativity becomes about the personality of creativity. So if you ask most people what creativity is, they'll say it's the domain of the Don Drapers of the world, the creative directors, the artists, the filmmakers. They don't see that it's just the way your spirit expresses itself and the way everybody's spirit expresses itself. And we need a different definition for creativity, rather than, one where I want a creative job because it's going to make me look good, or it's going to enhance my identity in some kind of way. So you can be a creative mother, you can be a creative cook, you could be a creative anything. So we've got to change the definition of creativity to one of it's your spirit. And once you get that, you can start to express yourself. And once you express yourself, it takes away all that need for, introspective healing, because the introspective healing goes on and on and on, and you keep, there's layers and layers and layers of it, and you can do 3 lifetimes of healing and not move on. And so it has become quite narcissistic, the self-help, healing, introverted movement. And I think creativity is the thing that pushes that outside and goes, well, I'm not healed yet, but it's probably a better use of my energy to express myself. And once you need to express your creativity, you need the energy that fuels creativity, which is love. And that love that comes through heals all the stuff anyway as a byproduct of the whole process. So you can take your head out of all this terrible navel gazing and sort of, go out and be a gift to the world. And that's a much better use of your energy than sitting in a workshop for ever and a day.
Yeah, I love the elements in the book where you talk about, the stacks of self-help books, and you have some pictures of them. and all the coaches, and going through the, what do I really need? Maybe I need an astrologer. Maybe it's the cosmos' fault.
Yeah, you know, forever.
There are so many things that you can blame all of these issues on. And you're right, the self-help movement, and this is something that Philip and I talk about personally a lot, the self-help movement has created a very me generation of navel gazers. So I love what you're doing, which is saying, okay, you've done enough of that. done enough of that introspection. Let's move out. I wanted to read something that you say. This was actually in day 20. I'm jumping ahead of myself because I want to go back to how you started on this journey.
Okay.
But what you just said about love is so eloquent and so beautiful. And this idea that love is the fuel. Love is the fuel behind everything. Love is really what makes us creative and what makes us real. And is the force that drives everything to move forward. But there's something that you say that I think is so important on day 20, when you're talking about the difference between supreme love and earthbound love. And it's so simple, and it's for me, it was so sharp. It brought me up and made me go, wow, we all need to think about this. And I'm going to read this little passage from your book where you say, just so we're clear of the difference, this is what supreme love sounds like. I love you. Now, this is what earthly love sounds like. I love you as long as you love me back and make me feel special, turn up on time, understand when I'm late, dislike the people I dislike, like the people I like, but not so much that you end up sleeping with them, show me affection when I'm feeling needy, keep your distance when I'm feeling independent, and know the difference between the two without me having to tell you, blah, blah, blah. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, it's one of those things that I think makes us all stand up and say, where are we being conditional and where are we being unconditional? And how do we work through this? I just, I, there, that that passage just grabbed me. I just thought it was so strong and so important, because it has become so hard for us to just say, I love you, and just be in that place. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that passage and about how you were feeling about love when you wrote that.
That passage is totally about Byron Katie's work, because when I approached my spiritual path with my left brain and was, being very kind of like, intellectual about spirituality, I came across Byron Katie, and she's so simple that it's just really powerful. She just asks four questions. She just says, is it true? How do you know it's true? I can't remember the other ones, but it's kind of like, I'd read this, all these kind of the Ken Wilber books and the cerebral stuff and the complexity and everything. And to see this woman have four questions and go, actually, it's that simple. In this situation, what am I trying to get? And things like if you're suffering, you're trying to get something. If you're just there to give, then where's the pain come from? If people don't love you back, it's like it's not your concern, because you're just about an outgoing process. So instead of a horizontal thing of give, get, I give you this, so I'm expecting something back, you wire up vertically so that you receive, and then you're just about giving, but you're not trying to get your needs met by the people around you. And, once I actually realized the truth of that, and, it's, so many spiritual truths are so simple and so profound, but we make them complex because we like to have, addendums to add on to them to feed our ego. But, most religions, come down to half a dozen truths at the end of the day, and everything else is stuff we make up and pile on top of it, So, Byron Katie just, hit me, over the head. And that was one of the times when I thought, no, it's an end of self-help, and it's the beginning of, the whole journey about love. And that's what she talks about. She just talks about love, and the difference between, and of course in Miracles talks about this as well, the difference between love, which is unconditional, and a special relationship, which has all that need attached to it. So yeah, Byron Katie, what a gal, brilliant.
Now, when I looked at 40 Days, 40 Nights, it reminded me somewhat of books like Eat, Pray, Love, and for this simple reason. There are a lot of people who realize, I think more subconsciously than consciously, that when they want to have change, they want to break out of the day-to-day routine and go to a place where they hope to find this inspiration. And obviously, in the case of Eat, Pray, Love, we know where that takes us. 40 Days, 40 Nights is the same theme from Britain to France. And it reminded me also that we really seem to have missed this part of our experience today. What we are doing an awful lot today is tourism. We go, to places and we sit there in the sun, or we do very normal things. But this spiritual aspect, this bit of pilgrimage, is really missing. And 40 Days, 40 Nights, makes that component in there in the pilgrimage. It also sits, I think, in a completely different manner, but like within the same category, of like The Way, the Estevez family's movie, whereby, again, people, realize that the road to Santiago de Compostela is a pilgrimage route, and they want to go there and find themselves. How do you experience personally this voyaging to new horizons as part of your self-discovery? Do you feel that other people should do it as well? And how should they go about it? Because it's not really just something which is a holiday abroad.
No, exactly. But I think that I think the reason it's powerful, the whole thing about pilgrimage, is that it takes you out of your head. And in the Western world, for the main part, we are so in our head. And the idea of getting into our heart is a concept. It's not a reality. So the best way for me to get out of the head is to get more into the senses, but we have to kind of amp up the senses in a certain way. So if we take the kind of five senses, I think that the pilgrimage is going beyond a five sensory world, put it that way. So if we take the visual thing, it's about increasing our peripheral vision so that we experience more. So that's easier when you're on a pilgrimage, obviously, than when you're on a commute into the office and you're in the middle of a concrete jungle. But it is possible to start to increase that spatial awareness so that you notice things, and you can train yourself to just start to notice things in your peripheral vision. That's a technique that you can practice. Similarly, hearing things, increasing your ability to tune in to stuff and increase your bandwidth, sensory perception. All these things are a kind of portal to an expanded experience of life. So for people who haven't got time to actually just take themselves out of their context, and sometimes it's not so great to do that, because if you take yourself out of the context, it's easy because you're in the middle of a completely different environment. You've got different food. You taste things. You sit down in France and you actually taste food. You don't grab a sandwich on your way to somewhere. There's a ritual to eating. There's a slowness about life that creates a ritual around things. And that allows you to have a sense of awe. And the thing that's missing in our daily lives now is that sense of awe. And so, because we've lost all the rituals, we've lost the idea of going into church because we've rejected religion, we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, so we don't know how to have a sense of awe. If we stand in front of a painting, you can see people going through the Louvre and they're just ticking the things off, and it's like, okay, I've done that picture, done that picture. You have to stand in front of a painting for some time to actually be able to experience the painting. It's not seeing it, it's experiencing it. So I think that it is possible to create these kind of rituals in your daily life without having to go on a pilgrimage, because quite often people who do go on the pilgrimage, as soon as they go back to their daily life, they don't have the tools, they don't have the mechanics in their brain, they haven't exercised the muscles required to be able to do it in their daily life, and so it's not long standing. People often go to workshops and they have an amazing time. Within 48 hours, they're exactly back to normal. They're yelling at their kids, they're stressed about this, so it doesn't hold, because it hasn't, you know, the change hasn't happened at a cellular level. It's happened in their head. And unless it's grounded more, you know, it's not going to actually sort of take root in the heart. So sometimes it's better to actually do the pilgrimage in your daily life and make small gains, but build the spiritual muscle so that its center will hold when you get hit with an emotion that you can't hold.
I definitely agree in terms of what you're saying with workshops and that kind of thing. I know a lot of people that go off to workshops and seminars on spirituality, and they feel great while they're doing them. I have participated in some of them. I have led some of them. And then after they go home, it's like you said, it's all over. They're back to yelling at the kids and hating their job. And they're not making any real changes. And I think we're all being pushed. One of the things I'm certainly feeling in 2012 is this move towards change. I think that we are all being pushed out of our comfort zone. I think that there is an energy toward forcing us to change. But I will say this, as someone who has led multiple pilgrimages in France in the last year, there is something that happens in France that, and I know that you will agree with this, and you even say in your book, if you can't be creative in France, you can't be creative anywhere. There is something that happens in France that is deeply and profoundly impactful, and it is not something that I can quantify or qualify. It's not something I can say, well, it's because of any of these things. But I think it's a combination of many things. I think that something happens when people go on pilgrimages to France, and I witnessed 100 people do this year, that does change them because of the rituals. As you explain, sitting down to eat and appreciate the love that went into the preparation and the love that goes into the service. All of those things are, you know, all of that has an impact. And there is something even in the land, specifically in the Southwest, in the Languedoc region, that is profoundly impactful. There is something about the land itself that I think has an impact on you physically and emotionally that does make a difference. And so my question for you, as the committed Francophile that I am, is you set off to take this journey of 40 days and had a transformational experience in the middle of it. Do you think that France itself was a part of that? Do you think if you had taken this journey anywhere, it would have been the same experience? Or do you think that there was something specific about France that speaks to our souls that might have had an impact on you?
I think it definitely has an impact on me, but then I do have a connection to France. And I have heard that, you know, I don't know whether it's past life thing or, but people often get a sense of that in a certain place. So that might be Greece or it might be Norway. They just go on holiday and they suddenly, you know, feel, whoa, you know, my sister went on a holiday to Israel and she never came back. She was like, she just knew. She got off the plane. She just went, there's something about this place. It's so familiar to me. I feel so comfortable here. She learned to speak fluent Hebrew. She got a job as a secretary. She was typing in Hebrew. I mean, she's extraordinary, but she just had that conviction of, it feels really right for me to be here. So I don't know whether France certainly does that for me, whether that's, it's universal that it does it for everybody or everybody has a certain place where they kind of feel drawn to the energy of it. I don't know. Also, you know, that France is known for, you know, real religious fervor. There's more churches per square mile than probably anywhere I know. And so I think there's something about the collective energy when you have things like pilgrimages and when you have places where people have often come to pray and to enter into a form of spiritual union and spiritual communion that lingers in the energy. And that's why the energy around Lourdes is very powerful. Whether you believe there was a visitation or not, it's irrelevant. You go to Lourdes and you can feel that the energy is different there. And maybe it's the energy of all the prayers over the centuries in one place that the place becomes infused with that. The stones become infused with that kind of energy.
Philip actually was reading my mind when he mentioned the comparison Eat, Pray, Love, because I was going to mention that as well, but I want to mention it with a caveat. I love your book for all the reasons I didn't love Eat, Pray, Love. I think that your book, 40 Days, 40 Nights, is the true questing, thinking woman's version of Eat, Pray, Love. I think women who loved Eat, Pray, Love will love your book because you have that, you know, there is that relatability, but there is so much more depth to the journey that you are on. I just wasn't a fan of Eat, Pray, Love. I felt like it felt like the navel-gazing me generation narcissistic version.
Right.
And so I didn't respond to it. Your book is what I wanted Eat, Pray, Love to be. because, you know, in every chapter, you break it up into days. You know, there is something to think about, but I'm so entertained as I'm reading it that I don't realize it. And the analogy I was going to give is this weekend, my 10-year-old had a sleepover at a friend's house, and the friend's mother is a friend of ours, and so she invited us for dinner, and she made this very beautiful pasta dish, and it was fantastic, and we all ate the pasta. And I realized as I was eating it that she had incorporated like little tiny pieces of broccoli and other vegetables into the sauce to get her 10-year-old boy to eat vegetables. And so what I realized is we were eating this fantastic, delicious pasta, but underneath there was all this stuff in it that was really, really good for us and made it really rich and complex in ways that, you know, you might not notice because all you're getting, you know, is how delicious it is. And I was thinking that that's how I feel about your book. It's so much fun to read, and I laughed out loud in so many places, and there were so many places where, you know, I wanted to call you and say, I love this story, or ask you a question about something that happened. But then when I would sit back and kind of sit with one of the days or one of the lessons, I realized that there were some really deep things going on here. And it really, what I think would be a great thing to do with this book, like in a reader's group or a women's group, is to kind of contemplate each one of those days over a 40-day period and the lessons that you have within it. Because I think that there's, you know, it's this wonderful combination of journey, but also handbook. Did you set out to write it this way? Or when you set off on this journey of discovery for 40 days, did you know you were going to write a book like this? Or did you just say, I'm going to go, I know you were writing a type of fiction originally, is that true?
Well, no, I was writing a self-help book, and I was blocked. So I had this self-help book, and I got so confused by the whole thing about marketing. There's so much now on internet marketing, and I'll say this for writers, because you can absolutely get overwhelmed by information and advice about, it's all about the premise, it's all about the title, it's all about the first line, it's all about this, that you wind up getting really stressed trying to kind of jump through all these hoops. And so, you know, I had this title and I thought, this is the title and this is the subline, and then I changed the title like four times. And so I it was a navigational tool, and I originally called it The Sextant, because that's, and I said in 40 days, right, I'm going to write, you know, it's going to be called The Sextant. And then I asked sort of five or six people, and they didn't know what a sextant was. So I thought, oh, that's the wrong title. You know, it's got to really sort of be really obvious. So I started writing a journal about writing a book, you know. So the beginning, when I first did it, it was just really a journal, you know, for me, about how to get over writer's block. And then the book became a book, because after 14 days writing every day in France, I got back to London. And every time I went to write something, which was the book I was writing, I didn't want to write that book. I wanted to carry on. And so I knew sort of intuitively, because I felt drawn to writing that rather than the book I should have been writing, that was probably the one I should go with. So I just carried it on.
I want to go back to the world of self-help and kind of like the world we live in today. We realize, I think, as a species and as individual people, whether that is men or women, that the old world is basically becoming outdated, that there needs to be a new world reborn whereby, you know, women can be redefined and men can also be redefined towards beings which they want to be. Very few of the generations currently listening to this, and anybody above the age of 20, I think, is really, a child of a new world. I think we are all still children of an old world, which means that we have been raised in the old world and we're trying to define, as you're calling it, a new archetype, this new world. That also means that parts of the old world are still with us. That might be children, that might be very mundane things like homes, finances, jobs. All of these things are kind of like there's this pull from the past saying, sure, you would like to have a new life, but. And pretty much most of the self-help groups don't deal with that. They basically are, as you say, very kind of like neo-theoretical. They give you a few tools and techniques which really don't work in real life. And so they get thrown out as soon as the new life comes back in, because the reality is that a workshop is 3 days or so in a sterile environment, so you can pretend it is a new world, but then the sterile environment becomes reality again, and those tools and techniques simply no longer work. Which means that there are an awful lot of self-help groups out there, self-help books out there. Help. How do we as a world, as individuals, really break or transform the paradigm? What are your insights in that?
I think it's about building emotional resilience because, you know, the whole thing, I think that the self-help skipped a thing because it sort of said, right, we've got to inhabit our heart. It's all about love. But unless you've got emotional resilience, you can't get into your heart because you'll just react to the first thing that comes along. And the whole self-help movement is sometimes, well, not all of it, but some of it is a little bit kind of the old definition of love, which is sentimental. Everything's got to be, you've got to be nice, you've got to be forgiving, you've got to be kind to everybody. And it's like that kind of sing-song Christians guitar playing kind of thing where everybody's lovely, lovely, and then they go outside and there's road rage and they're, you know, they get in the car and they fight over the car parking space and everything. It's more about getting to be emotionally strong, because an emotionally strong heart is able to love in a different way and not in a sentimental way. So we've been brought up for years and years and years on the idea of love as country and Western songs and as romance and as kind of different roles. But, you know, real love quite often, you know, means that you can know what's true. And sometimes the truth isn't always the easy path, and it isn't always nice, you know, yet it's still true. And so knowing what's true, you can't know what's true unless you've got resilience in your heart, because you'll just do what's nice, or you'll do what's the thing you're supposed to do. So it may be that, you know, you're confronted with a situation or a scene or an environmental movement or a project, and it's like, get involved with this, get involved with that. And it may be true for you to get involved, and it may not be true for you to get involved, because, you know, sometimes that's not your path. And a lot of people get confused about that, and they get pulled every which way because they think, oh, now I'm a spiritual person. I'm supposed to be answering this cause and joining this project and helping this member of my family who's not doing well. And they end up in sacrifice, and they end up giving from a place of lack, which, you know, means that then they feel resentful. So they go on a loop of giving, 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 giving. Oh, I feel really resentful. And then they're just on a hamster wheel. So I think the key thing is not to forget this thing about building emotional resilience, because when emotional intelligence first came in, you know, Thomas Kuhn and the whole thing about emotional intelligence first started being talked about, people in business, you know, were saying, oh, we don't want that emotional stuff. And now people in business are saying, oh, we need that emotional stuff. And it's all the fluffy kind of aspect of emotional intelligence. But I think that Marianne Williamson says it kind of best, that what's a terrorist but an emotion with a gun? So an emotion is not a trivial thing. It's not a fluffy sort of thing that women feel, you know, on an off day. It's a really powerful force, and people have to learn how to deal with emotion. And there's more emotion, I think, in the world now, in the energy, in the collective consciousness, than ever. It's almost like there's an astral level of a garbage, a dumping ground of all the unresolved emotions. And that's just lingering like a layer. And as soon as something flares up, like the riots in London, suddenly there's a fault line in that, and it comes through and people just go mental. And then, you know, 48 hours later, they go, I had no idea why I did that. And nice middle class people were throwing bricks through windows, and they were just under the grip of emotions that they just couldn't process and couldn't handle. So I think that's kind of key to the whole thing, is learning how to have a powerful emotion and not act out from it, and just run it through your body and hold your ground and stay centered and not throw it at somebody else, not play table tennis with it, not let it go into rage or self-attack or misery or despair. That is such a simple thing, but it's like would completely transform the whole world. And it's not even taught in schools which is insane. You know, it's not even on the curriculum. How to deal with an emotion that hits you from left field, that just, you know, without doing all those things.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we have gone from an environment where we were taught to not necessarily have emotions, but definitely to suppress them or keep them to ourselves. And, you know, I've lived in various parts of the world, and definitely Britain, I think, is a country where the emotional suppression in public displays is extraordinarily regulated. America is a bit more open about that. But largely as a whole, you know, we were told to keep our emotions in check. And then all of a sudden we are told by whoever, even though nobody in specific, that we are allowed to have emotions. And then straight away we have no idea what to do with them. We act out on them immediately. And as you say, like, you know, this has gone from riots in London. And I think what's lacking there is actually this idea, okay, I'm having an emotion here. Let's analyze it a bit. I mean, you know, not too intellectually, but kind of like, what is this emotion? What should I do? Rather than, we have gone from this, no emotion at all, suppressing it, to immediately acting out. And I think, you know, living within the emotion is something which I think is important on so many levels. And, I think, you know, to some extent, lovemaking and all of these things, the way they are in this world right now are very much, you know, this immediate satisfaction, this need of, I have an emotion, I need to resolve it straight away, now. And to some extent, it's the other extreme. So building your emotional resilience, or becoming emotionally resilient, I think is definitely a very interesting thing.
You see, I think that's where the creativity comes in, because that's the channeling of the energy. You know, mm-hmm. if you can some way have an emotion and channel it into something creative, then it becomes something entirely different.
Well, and to your point about them, they don't teach this in schools. I mean, can you imagine what would happen if we could raise an entire generation of children who were taught how to deal with their emotional reactions and how to channel them creatively? I don't know if this is happening in the UK, but certainly in the US, most creative subjects have been removed from the public schools. There's just no funding for them. So the first thing to go is creativity, is art, is music. You know, anything that allows kids to channel their energy into a creative force is now eliminated from the majority of public schools here in the States, which is a very scary thing. And is that happening in the UK? And how do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm so furious about it. I can't tell you. I mean, it's happening in the UK. It's this whole thing about there's a whole circle that's the problem, that the parents want the children to do really well. And their parents are insecure that because there's no jobs. So they really want to have their children be able to come out of education and have a job. Otherwise, it's going to hit their own buttons of feeling insecure and fearful for their children. And they think that an education is going to give them a job, because that's old paradigm. Of course, it doesn't mean anything anymore. And so they put them through these schools. The only way they can evaluate schools is through testing and through results. But the thing is, you can't test for creativity. You can't, you don't have the same kind of metrics to do with creativity as you have with science subjects and factual subjects. And so if it can't be measured, well, it can't be in the curriculum, because otherwise how can we say that this school's better than that school? How can we get people to put their kids in my school rather than the other school? And so all that competition and fear mongering and insecurity about the job market makes people put these kids into these sausage factories so that they come out with degrees, which is insane, because in China they're knocking out, you know, graduates, you know, every 3 minutes with engineering degrees. And the thing that's needed now more than anything is that thing that's missing, the thing that has the intangible value. But the problem is that how do we have conversations about intangible value? It's we don't have a language for it. And so You know, it doesn't have a kind of monetary thing that we can actually prove and put aside. We know when it's missing, but, you know, we can't evaluate, you know, the value of it in pounds, shillings and pence, because it's to do with the culture and the environment of, you know, the office place. And if an office is, you know, very happy and creative, and you can't really, you know, put that down on the bottom line so easily as you can things that, you know, you can stick on an Excel spreadsheet. So, you know, the whole thing is a mess, really, because, you know, we're still doing education from the dark ages. And now we need people who can think outside the box, who can be innovative, who can, but you can't have innovation and creativity if you've got a totally left brain education. It's just the two don't go together.
Well, and that's happening here in a really big way. For example, children are tested here to determine if they're gifted, but they're tested with something called the Raven Matrixes, which is a puzzle-solving test that is entirely to do with logic. And in fact, people who ultimately will go into advanced mathematics and engineering are essentially the only people who are passing this. That and highly functioning autistic children are able to pass it. But what's happening is kids who are extraordinarily gifted, even gifted as writers or speakers, are being completely left behind now. And the only children who are being identified in the American public school systems as gifted are extremely cerebral, mathematically inclined kids. Language skills and art skills aren't even considered anymore because it's too hard, as you say, it's too hard to quantify, it's too hard to identify. It's much easier and it's inexpensive to issue a simple Scantron test with puzzles to see if a child can logically solve a puzzle quickly, then he is classified as gifted and then moved into a gifted program. So what we have now is we have an entire generation of kids coming through the American school systems who are only being identified as gifted because they're highly functioning in terms of mathematics and engineering skills, and we have no children who are being recognized for anything else. And what that bodes for the future, I think, is truly terrifying. And as a result, what I am seeing is a lot of very progressive parents here are pulling their kids out of school and going into homeschooling and, you know, different types of curriculums now to get away from that. So it's, you know, it's interesting, but it's part of this new world that we are on the brink of. And one of the things that's got to change is the way that we recognize what our children are capable of.
Yeah, I think it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
How do you feel overall, Eleanor, about 2012? We decided that at the beginning of this year that we were going to ask all of our guests to talk about this whole concept of 2012, what 2012 means to them. What does it mean to you? What kind of connotations does this world of 2012 carry for you personally?
I think it means that, you know, things are going to change. I mean, it's obvious that things are going to change because the system is broken. Everything's broken. Politics is broken. Business is broken, the financial system is broken. And so, you know, things are going to change, whether that change is harsh and brutal and uncomfortable or easy is up to us, but it will change. I don't think there's going to be any major apocalypse. I just think that life as we know it is going to be very different. I am optimistic that there are enough people now who, because they've either been through the system and it's not working for them, or because they've been through the system and it is working for them, but they feel lonely and unhappy and sad inside, that they feel that unfulfilled, and so therefore it's not working for them, even though on the surface it might be working for them. I think there's enough people now. It's just that they're not joined up in an adequate way. There's nobody that represents them. There's nobody that they can line up behind so easily. They're disillusioned with leaders that, first of all, they were disillusioned with the women leaders. And they thought, great, yeah, a woman. And then it was like, oh my God, she's worse than a man. And then it's like, oh, now we've got a great liberal kind of leader. Oh, but he's in the back pocket of, you know, all the financiers. And people are now disillusioned to the point where they think, we have to find our own network. We have to build our own networks, and we have to build critical mass in that way, because there isn't anybody out there on the world stage that we can line up behind with confidence. So, but I am optimistic that that will happen, because we do have the tools now to make it happen with the internet.
And to some extent, that means kind of like, you know, we are in a world of self-help in the sense that, as you say, there are no great examples out there. And to a large extent, I think it is because the archetype or the example of future man and future woman, doesn't really exist, at this moment in time. It is something which, you know, needs to, come out. So many of the, people want to look up to, even if it's, you know, according to the old archetype. I take, for example, the Republicans right now. You know, they're looking for somebody who doesn't exist either, and they can't find this creature who they would like to exist, but it doesn't. The Democrats here, you know, thought it was Obama, then realized it wasn't. And everybody is kind of looking for, you know, Sarkozy in France. So many places, Tony Blair, a decade ago, 15 years ago in the UK, all of these people came up to the public forefront with great hope, with great promise, but all of them are lacking. And I think it's to a sense, first of all, that we do put too much emphasis on them, that we pretend they are something which they never were. We wanted them to be something which they never were. And that it is not as easy as that. I think that's probably the most important thing. Bringing about global change, radical global change, isn't as easy as just one guy or one woman, kind of like, you know, filling the role of this archetype. I think, as you were saying, archetypes need to be created, with the stress on creation. It is something whereby hundreds, millions of people basically contribute a building block to the creation of this archetype, and then the archetype comes about, and that's sort of how it works, archetypes, rather than the cult of celebrity or the cult of example. So, Eleanor, unfortunately, we have come to the end of our show, but it's been extraordinarily enlightening.
It's just such fun. Thank you so much.
And I, you know, I'm compiling a list of great tools for 2012, and I'm going to send out a little bit of an email to my group, and I'm going to post it on my website and on Facebook. You know, that some of the books and tools and voices who are creating spirit revolution, and things that I really recommend for 2012. And your book, 40 Days, 40 Nights, One Woman's Quest to Reclaim Her Creative Mojo, is going at the very top of it. I think it's a fantastic tool. I think everyone should be reading your blogs, because it will make them laugh and make them think and feel better. We will put all of this information up on the website. If you go to thespiritrevolution.com, you will be able to find links to Eleanor's book. Run, Don't Walk, and get a copy of this book. You can get it on Amazon. And we will be adding all of that.
You also have your own website, Eleanor, which is Eleanor O'Rourke, which is ELEANOROROURKE .com. If you want to go to our website, that is thespiritrevolution.com, you can listen to this interview, as well as the last five interviews which we've done. You can go to iTunes, where you can listen to more than a year and a half of interviews. And you can also go to the BBS Radio archives at bbsradio.com. For there, you will be able to access for a small fee all of our shows of the last 2 years and 3 weeks. And also so many other shows which are on the BBS Radio network. We will be back next week with another guest, but until then, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.